Good morning. We're going to call the Government Operations and Election Policy Committee meeting to order. Representative Fenton, have you had a chance to look at the minutes from March 16th?
I haven't, so I moved the minutes from March 16th.
Thank you, Representative Fenton. Any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of the minutes from March 16th, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Minutes are adopted. All right. With that, we will welcome Representative Petersburg to the testifiers table for House File 2270. Where is this going? I'll move that House File 2270 be referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. Representative Petersburg, I see that we have a DE amendment in the packet. Is that your author's amendment?
That is correct.
I will move the DE amendment to put the bill in the shape the author wishes. Any quick discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of the DE1 to put the bill in the shape the author wishes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The DE1 is adopted. Representative Petersburg, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. Thank you for hearing this bill. This bill really is a grassroots bill. It has started not much more grassroots than in the sixth grade in the Owatonna public school system, and I have six testifiers that would like to testify in regards to that. But if I could give just a little bit of background before they get started. With the Capitol under construction and pretty much off limits to field trips, a lot of schools have done some research on the Capitol, which included Miss Jennifer Hansen, the teacher. And they came up with a lot of research and questions about the Capitol and questions about how come the cornerstone has the name of Cass Gilbert and all of the officials that did it, but nothing to commemorate all of the workers that actually built the Capitol along with, and you'll hear some stories later, so I'm not going to pass that on at this point. And I don't want to give a lot of detail because I want each of the kids to have their presentation here. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would like to turn over to our testifiers, and then I'll have some final comments when you are finished.
Excellent. Thank you, Representative Petersburg.
Before I do that, I did want to say, so I was contacted by the teacher saying that they had something to present to me, and so they presented me with this, which is a petition. It's 70 pages, and there's about 700 signatures on it from all over the state, even a few from outside of the state and in other states, and they presented that with me as to something that they really worked on as a class and really put their heart and souls into it. And so we appreciate their work, appreciate what they've learned, and I hope that you will hear that in their pride as well. So with that, I'll turn it over to them. Chloe.
Thank you. Good morning, kids. Welcome to committee. Welcome to St. Paul. Thanks for all your work on this. If you would, when each of you gets up there, just state your name so we have it for the record, and you'll forever be a part of history once you do that. So,
okay. My name is Chloe Beattie, and I'm here to represent Felix Arthur. On July 27th, 1898, marching bands led thousands of people to the highest point in downtown St. Paul, Minnesota. Hundreds of veterans, stone cutters, and other workers marched to the ribbon-draped speaker's stand. Here, the new Capitol was rising from the ground. Onlookers leaned over the partially finished first-floor walls.
My name is Tad Johnson. Among the many dignitaries was Minnesota's first territorial governor, Alexander Ramsey, to officially lay the cornerstone for the People's House, the grandest building in the state and one of the finest state house buildings in the country.
My name is Gabe Adams. The cornerstone was 5 feet long with a hollow core to hold a copper box. Into the box were placed more than 45 books, newspapers, photos, and documents, including histories of legislators and soldiers since the founding of the state. The names of the Capitol commissioners and architect Cass Gilbert, as well as his associates, were etched on a bronze plate.
But the box contained not a single name of a worker or contractor who erected the structure. Since construction began in 1896, hundreds of workers were drawn to this spot. They dug and laid the foundation and built the lower walls. Hundreds more came to work there through the building's completion in 1907.
I'm Katie Erke.
These people all came together to create this Minnesota treasure, but they have remained nameless. It is time to right this wrong. These workers have waited 119 years to be recognized for their contributions to our state.
I'm Lynn Bateman. Last year in Mrs. Hansen's Minnesota Studies class, we helped to organize a letter-writing campaign and obtain more than 700 signatures on a petition in hopes to secure a memorial for these men and women. We sent letters to Minnesota lawmakers to appropriate funds to erect a memorial or a plaque in the Minnesota State Capitol, recognizing the efforts of these people, especially those that lost their lives during the construction.
I am here to represent Felix Arthur. Felix Arthur was the first worker to lose his life while building the state capitol. He came north with the controversial white Georgia marble. On May 5, 1898, Felix was working on a stone polishing machine when he got caught in the flywheel and died the next day in St. Joseph's Hospital in St. Paul.
I am here to represent John Biersack. John Biersack, a 36-year-old son of Bavarian immigrants, died in October 1898, a few days after he fell from a derrick.
I am here to represent Florian Zahner. On August 3, 1900, Florian Zahner, a 40-year-old German-born laborer, fell to his death while wheeling brick on scaffolding to be used in the pediment over truss number one. On the House of Representatives, Florian fell to the ground and was killed. The wheelbarrow ran off the scaffolding, and in trying to keep it from falling, he fell to his death.
I am here to represent Alfred Magnusson. Alfred Magnusson, a 23-year-old Swedish stonemason, also fell to his death in 1900. Magnusson became the fourth death on the job when he fell while setting roof trusses over the Senate chamber.
I am here to represent Albert Swanson. Albert Swanson, a 20-year-old mold caster from Sweden, was killed in a strange accident. A passing wagon drove over a rope used to hoist material and scaffolding on which men stood. The rope pulled the scaffolding down with Albert Swanson and Frank Theory, and both plunged 40 feet. Swanson collided with timbers and died. Theory landed in a pile of sand and miraculously got away with only a broken leg.
I'm here to represent John Corrigan. On June 25, 1903, John Corrigan, an 18-year-old laborer, fell 32 feet near the Senate chamber. The young man was just a week or two on the job at the state capitol when he fell to his death. John was the last fatal accident to occur at the state capitol building site.
And I'm Jen Hansen, 6th grade teacher, Willow Creek Intermediate, Owatonna. I'm here to represent my fantastic students with their inquisitive minds who are asking great questions. And I'm here to represent the other 90 students on this project that were not able to attend with us. Their efforts to memorialize the men and the women who built our state capitol, these students saw the beauty and the structure that was built to stand the test of time. They recognized the skill of the craftsmen, the masons, and the sculptors. And in a day and age where young people look at the new and the shiny, they saw the beauty in the old and the marvelous. They recognized the work of the men and the women from 119 years ago and wanted to recognize their contribution to the great state of Minnesota. We hope that you will support House File 2499, this bill, and help us to recognize those that are long gone, but to whom we are forever grateful. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen, and thank you to each of you students for coming here again for your testimony today. You've now officially testified in an official House committee, so thank you very much. You all did an awesome, fantastic job. So thank you very much for the time that you took to memorialize these individuals and bring some history back to this historical place. Representative Petersburg.
They, as well as I, am certainly open to any questions that you might have about the bill. If not, I will have my closing comments.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Petersburg, thank you for bringing this forward. As a carpenter and someone that walks through that building and just marvels at how it's been built and how it looks, and would love to have worked on a building like that. We don't build them like that anymore. It's a grand building, and thanks to all the kids here for bringing this issue forward. As you were talking about this, did you think about adding the current workers that are doing the major remodeling on that, as far as if they're going to put a plaque up honoring them also? I know the names are going to be for the people that passed away on that. And but have you ever thought up, did you think about possibly adding that in into the bill?
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hans. We at this point, the petition and so forth came about just in regards to the original construction. In consequential discussions with Historical Society and others, there has been some discussion about that, and I don't think that may still happen, again, because the parameters of this particular plaque is being designed and determined by the Historical Society as well as the board. That certainly could be added to the parameters of that. But I know the students were really looking at the history of the original building itself, and so they chose that particular area. But that certainly would be something that could be considered.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, with the amount of work going on there, and, you know, hopefully 100 years from now, that, like I said, we're not going back and honoring the current workers, because they're basically reconstructing a lot of what was built. I know there's been articles and news reports on the front steps, and they opened them up, the amount of damage there, and the amount of work that's had to be done to that. Please give us some thought.
Thank you very much.
Any other member questions, thoughts, comments, discussion? Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Petersburg, in my 6 years here, I have not seen a group of testifiers more well-prepared to be able to address an issue in quite a long time in front of a committee, and that's hats off to you too, Ms. Hansen, for your work on preparing folks. My question is, where did you find the information about the individual workers, you know, wheelbarrow, 32 feet, falling to death in this area, or the flywheel, dying at St. Joseph's Hospital? Where would we have gotten that information from?
Mr. Chair and Representative Driscoll, I'm going to turn that over to Chloe because I think she has the information for you.
Go ahead, Chloe.
We found the information for the workers that passed away making the Capitol. We looked it up on the internet most of the time, and we looked in books, and we found all of the resources we could to find how the workers were and how they died.
Thank you, Chloe. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted at this, you know, we're talking about workers injured. I know the building trades every year has Workers' Memorial Day, and they have a presentation. Unfortunately, construction is very dangerous work, and from time for every year we seem to lose one or two people in the trades that are injured on construction jobs. And so we do this every year. We honor the workers that passed away, and they do that at the Workers' Memorial that's on the in the Capitol. The lawn out front of the Capitol, there's a structure there that honors those people that have died in work.
Thank you.
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Petersburg and group. I just, again, want to reiterate what Representative Nelson has said. Coming from the building and remodeling industry, it is really dangerous, but I think one of the things this really represents is how many folks really, it was fatal for them to build the existing structure. And when we look at the remodel that's happening now, we're seeing the advancements that have been made in the construction industry, and we're not hearing of all these deaths. So while I would like to reiterate what Representative Nelson has said in that, I hope that we can also maybe either move forward or find a way to add the folks that are working now. We're hoping not to add to the fatalities, but basically to the honor of the work that they do. That would be really a really nice step to do. It really is important for us to remember the folks that did give their lives to this wonderful structure. And I hope that you're able to make it next year when everybody can go through the Capitol again and see the wonderful work that has been done. So we'll look forward to seeing you next year, right? Thank you.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think I heard Representative Petersburg say that there were some parameters that are being formed up by the Capitol, whatever, Capitol Architectural Board. So could you just confirm exactly then what they're going to do at this point with the design parameters?
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Chair, as well as Representative Renbeck. Yes, you'll notice in Part B of that discussion there. It talks about the Capital Area Architectural and Planning Board, and I also understanding we need to pull the Historical Society into that because they are the ones that really control how this preservation is occurring and so forth. It was felt that they would be should be the ones that would set the parameters, understanding maybe where the location is going to be and so forth, so that those that are in charge of the Capitol will have the final say over how the design and stuff may occur. We felt it was unrealistic to ask for the sixth graders to put together a design if we didn't give them the parameters from which to work with. And so we have really asked that they set that parameter and also determine how the contest was going to be worked throughout the state, feeling that this gives an opportunity for all sixth graders across the state who aren't able to come to the Capitol for field trips and so forth, still be involved with what's happening at the Capitol to learn more about how bills are made and so forth, and continue on the great work that the Historical Society and others have do in this particular Capitol building.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the students themselves, I'm sure you're making plans for attending the commemoration of the plaque itself, and I look forward to that. And to the point, Representative Petersburg, if you could just expand a little bit on the contest itself in terms of the timeline for the rollout of that, and when, if there's any identification in terms of when the plaque will actually be installed.
Representative Petersburg.
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, it is designed that the board would make the decision by January 1 of 2017 with enough time in order to actually get it created and put in place, understanding that the Capitol will be open for the public January 1st, but that there will be a few ongoing minor adjustments and additions done throughout at least the first 6 months of 17. Gives us an opportunity to get it done by the time full completion of the Capitol is being done. So that is our hope, and it would certainly be up to the parameters of the board to decide that. The legislation here, it says that it has to be done by that date, not that it can't be done earlier if they so choose.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank the students for having an interest in history. It really is nice to see in all the work that you did, and for your teacher for thinking of a creative way to keep you engaged in the Capitol, even though you couldn't visit. I noticed you came up. I think you had something more to add about how you guys did the research, if you want to let us know.
Mrs. Hanson said that we should go on who built our state capitol website, and she was helping with building and making the website. So we were researching on that website to find a lot of information.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'll just start with Representative Petersburg. This was a great, great bill. I'm just so delighted. I can't recall a more fun hearing. And to the students, I'm just so impressed with your presentation. And I learned so much from each and every one of you and what you shared. And I'm sure that all Minnesotans who may be watching anything that was captured here today will have as well. And to the teacher, Ms. Hanson, just so wonderful. You know, what inspiration you've offered your students. History is so important. I happen to have, unfortunately, only four, but I'm working on securing more right now. But I have a pin that I would like to present to each of your students, and it's from the Minnesota Historical Society. And I'm not certain if anyone is here from the History Center or the Historical Society, one of our state agencies, but when they hear about your involvement in this project, they're going to be really impressed as well. So it's a little pin of the state capitol, and would very much like to encourage you to come back here next year, and we'll welcome you back. So if I could have a page, grab these, that'd be great.
Do you have anything to add, sir?
I do. This has been a great experience. I'd like to thank Chloe for asking this question that rose this big occasion. And I'd like to thank Ms. Hansen for setting this all up. It's actually been really fun. I mean, I thought I was gonna be nervous, but I mean, it flew by. I'd also like to thank everyone here. I mean, even you guys.
Thank you. I think that's the first time we've ever been thanked.
I think this is a very, very serious topic because death is a very serious thing. And I'm glad you all see that a memorial is very well deserved.
So thank you. Thank you for your comments.
Wow.
Well, any final member questions or discussion?
Yeah.
Is there any other testimony in the audience for or against the bill? Seeing none, Representative Petersburg, we'll give you closing comments.
How do I follow that up? I just asked for your support.
I wouldn't if I was you.
Thank you for allowing us to testify. Appreciate it.
Thank you. And thank you again, students, very much for your time and testimony today. It meant a great deal to us and to the state of Minnesota, so thank you for that. With that, members, I will renew my motion that House File 2270 be referred to the Committee on State Government Finance as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is approved. House File 2270 is on its way to State Government Finance. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Next on the agenda, we have House File 2603, Representative Green. Representative Green, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
I will go ahead and move House File 2603 to be referred to the Committee on Civil Law. And it appears that you have an A1 amendment. Is that an author's amendment?
Yes.
With that, members, I will also move the A1 to put the bill in the shape that the author wishes. Any brief discussion to that? Seeing none, members, all in favor of the A1 for putting the bill in the shape the author wishes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is approved. The A1 is adopted. Representative Green, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 2603 is a really simple bill. It came about because... concerns in my area from citizens who have been participating in the open houses that the agency, DNR agency, had put on in regards to land acquisition. And in an open house, what happens is when you come into the room, there'll be a series of tables, and you'll go around and you'll get information individually at the tables, but there's no opportunity for the people to get together in an open meeting and discuss and ask questions back and forth. And what this bill will do is require that we go back to the open meeting, and an open house would not then constitute substitute for the open meeting. And that's really the bill. It's pretty simple. I think that it allows for citizens to have what I think is guaranteed in our law. So, and I think there's testifiers from the DNR, but otherwise I'll take questions.
Excellent. You can come on up, Commissioner. Introduce yourself for the record, please, and go ahead with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources, and we were just speaking with Representative Green about the issues that he has. There's a couple parts to this bill that I'd like to discuss briefly is the open meeting requirements before acquisition. By state statute, the department is required to obtain county board approval before we would acquire a wildlife management area or a scientific and natural area. So we are having that public meeting with the county boards and seeking that approval. If they deny it, there is an option for us to go to the Land Exchange Board, which is the executive council, subcommittee of that, governor, lieutenant governor, secretary of state. We have never done that, or we have never done that in 25 years, to go beyond the wishes of a county board. We always try to work things out with them. In addition, if we're buying parkland, it has to be within the boundaries of a state park that the legislature has to approve, and forested land is the same way. We can only buy forest land that's within the state forest boundaries. So I think those two pieces are being met. And I spoke with Representative Green by requiring us to have open houses that have an opportunity for public comment, or Section 2 here, when a state agency is required by law to hold a meeting for the opportunity for public comment or testimony, an open house does not constitute a meeting. This has been an effective way for us to get more information out to people. Maybe Representative Green and I discussed things. If we have an open house, it has to provide for opportunity for public comment or something like that. If you look at the PolyMet public meetings that we had with thousands of people, I think we had 20,000 people attend the meeting statewide or something like that. We had a public open house, and then we took comments after that. So it allows the citizens of the state to go and seek information on water quality or financial assurance or on land exchange or things like that. So I can understand the concern Representative Green has, the feeling that his constituents aren't being heard at these meetings, and I can guarantee you with or without this language, we will be trying to adapt that need into our processes into the future. So I guess we do have some concerns about the language in Sections 1 and 3. We feel we're already meeting those needs. And in Section 2, we are going to try to do something to meet the representative's needs. So with that, I can stand for questions.
Thank you. Representative Rumbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Meyer. So you said that the phrase, take public comment, and I'm curious what the format of those public comments are. Because my experience is sometimes you just get to write a comment on a card. And so when you say that, are you a person up at the front and people can stand and publicly voice their comments?
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, that would be my intention. The form, it would depend on the type of meeting, right? If it's a huge meeting, we might take, you know, depending on how much time we have, we would, just like we do with testimony most of the time in committees, take a sample or take pro and cons. For example, this is a great example, actually. Last week we had a meeting in the DNR cafeteria from 6 o'clock to 9 o'clock dealing with lead shot. So we came in, we had a presentation that we had, a PowerPoint, 15, 20-minute discussion, and then we opened it up to public comment. We had red cards and green cards or different colored cards for pros and cons, opponents, proponents, and we let them go one at a time, one on each side, until everybody had spoken. So whether that would conflict with the language in the law, but we want to make sure we're hearing people and answering their questions and getting their comments on the record. So whatever we need to do to make sure that's happening, we're more than willing to work with Representative Green and the legislature to do so.
Follow-up, Representative Rumbeck?
Not necessarily, no.
Representative Nelson.
I thought Representative Peters, Representative Green had his hand up. He wanted to respond to that. Okay. I guess the question I have, Mr. Myers touched on part of what I was thinking about, because my understanding is they do have to go to county board or the state, to a state committee to do that, so that is a public meeting. So I don't know if this is this is being redundant. I know we want as much opportunity out there for the public to react to these things. And I know in northern Minnesota, where Representative Green represents, that there is a lot of concern up there and feedback that they think that DNR and a lot more property up there is publicly owned, and it's a concern for the local municipalities that infringes on their tax base. So I can understand wanting to have as much information as possible and feedback, but I guess why isn't what they're doing now at the county board, why isn't that a meet that qualification in your mind, Representative Green?
Representative Green.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, I don't believe that it meets the expectations of the people, at least not in my area. And with an open meeting, you have the opportunity for an open exchange and ideas to be moved back and forth. In the scenario that Mr. Myers is presenting, it's structured. It is designed to hold back. I think it's maybe not designed, but the result is it holds back public comment. You are required to write down your question, and everything is structured. There's no conversing back and forth of ideas. It would be the same thing if in here, if you weren't allowed to ask a question unless you wrote it down and sent it to the chair. I think that our system in the laws, when it talks about open meetings that local governments have to have, is designed for the same thing. You don't want to withhold comments from the people. You want to get them out there and have that open exchange of ideas.
Mr.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess that's why I'm asking. They're currently, for acquisition, have to go to a county board to get approval. And isn't that, they're bound by the open meeting laws. So right there, they're having an open meeting before they do it. They're doing informational ahead of time and then having that open meeting at the county board to discuss this and get it voted on. I guess that's why I'm asking, why doesn't that rise to what you consider an open meeting?
This, Representative Green.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, and Representative Nelson. This goes right back to what I was talking about. But to give you an idea of what happens here when you have an open house, at one of the events in my area, we had a group of people. There was at least 25 and probably more that came to testify or to voice their opinion on a land acquisition project. And I won't go into the whole details because it's not probably relevant here. But they came in expecting to have an open meeting, and they even filled up the chairs in the room. And they came to the realization that there was not going to be an open meeting. If they had any comments, they would have to go from table to table and talk to individual representatives of the DNR. And they were extremely upset over it. And when they expressed their opinion and turned it into an open meeting themselves, they were accused by some of the folks there of hijacking the meeting. And we are here not to represent the DNR. We are here to represent the people of Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And the people of Minnesota expect an opportunity to be able to voice their opinions on these issues that are so important to them. These issues that we're talking about here affect their very livelihood. And this is not a complicated issue. This is an issue of openness and just being able to voice your opinion in an area that affects your life and the lives of your children.
Representative Nelson, any follow-up?
Just a little follow-up here. I guess the question goes on, and we're talking. You're talking DNR here. The amendment adds the Minskew College system with. But it doesn't include any other state agencies or state groups that are, or local groups that might be acquiring land. Why not include the University of Minnesota? Why not include any acquisition by counties? Why not include cities in this? I mean, why is it just limited basically right now to the DNR and Minskew?
Representative Green.
Mr. Chair, it's not. If you read in Section 2, it says a state agency. The reason that Minskew was put in there is because the nonpartisan staff had indicated that they weren't classified as an agency. This is my understanding of what they told me. And so by putting them in, then they are added to the rest of the group. And this isn't an issue against the DNR. This is an issue about land acquisition and the open meeting and having people, giving people the opportunity to voice their opinion.
Representative Joaquin.
Oh, thank you, Chair. Just a few quick questions. Maybe Council can help me. It's my understanding, I had a different question, but I'll get to it now. Representative Nelson's question piqued my curiosity. U of M is not considered a state agency either, is it? It has state constitutional autonomy.
Ms. Dyson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Joaquin, that's correct.
So they would
Representative
not be
Joaquin.
Thank you, Chair. I'm sorry. They would not be included under this.
That's Ms.
Correct.
Dyson?
In Chapter 16B, agency has a defined term, and it means all the state agencies, but not Minskew unless you add Minskew in. So this will cover all of the state agencies, and with the amendment, Minskew, but not the University of Minnesota.
Thank you.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Chair. And then another question, and maybe I'm just getting confused with the different terminologies. Is there a statute, a state statute, defining what a public, public meeting is, a public open meeting?
Ms. Dyson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Joaquin, Chapter 13D of Minnesota Statutes is the Minnesota Open Meeting Law. And it applies to state agencies, boards, commissions, public bodies, all local governments. Typically, when you're talking about a meeting, you're talking about a governing body that is either that's holding a meeting. there's a lot of case law that defines when you have a meeting. It's when you have a quorum of the governing body that is either gathering information or making decisions.
And Representative Joaquin, that's also why this is going to civil law nexus, the Chapter 13 reference in Section 3.
Understandable. Chair, then just a quick question on definition then. Is there definition in how comments are supposed to be recorded or collected that would be different between collecting comments in an open house format versus a public meeting? Is there a specific way you're supposed to be collecting comments in a public meeting? Because from what I'm hearing from Representative Green, and I agree, it's really important to get input from the community when you're making big decisions. I was on a city council for 9 years, and from my experience in a public meeting, we collected comments. It was recorded. We heard what people said, but that back and forth that you would like was stilted because as electeds, we weren't allowed to answer back to people. Where open house formats, it was more of a back and forth and a dialogue, and people could get their questions answered there. So I'm just wondering if there's a definition in law about how comments are supposed to be collected or recorded that would make a difference between a public meeting and an open house. Just to make sure we're getting those comments.
Ms.
I'm
Dyson?
Sorry, that's really convoluted.
Mr. Chair and Representative Joaquin, in general, the open meeting law on its own does not require a governing body to accept testimony. So when you want to require a meeting to take testimony, you put it in statute. In Section 3 of the bill, which it says that before acquiring real property, the agencies, the tie into the open meeting law is that before acquiring property, he's requiring special meeting notice. So that's the 3-day notice to interested parties who say they want notice, and then posting on the door of the agency or the bulletin board, or however the notice is required. But it's that the special meeting notice is 3 days, and then the bill says that there has to be an opportunity for public comment at that meeting. In Chapter 13D, there's nothing particular about requiring the public to be able to comment at a meeting.
Does that help, Representative Joaquin?
Yes. One more follow-up, Chair. Mm-hmm. Then could another way to be addressed this to make sure the public is given notice would be to do a notice requirement before an open house versus saying an open house doesn't qualify? I've just found them to be a lot more helpful when it comes to answering people's questions and having that back and forth dialogue to really get to what people are worried and interested about.
Ms. Dyson, do you care to offer any thoughts on that? Or,
Mr. Chair and members, I think that is something for the committee to discuss.
Thank you, Ms. Dyson. And certainly not just this committee, but also the Civil Law Committee as well will have detailed discussions on this as well. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Chair.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think my question is pretty broad. I'm trying to envision how this improves upon our current open meeting statutes and how meetings that might not currently be considered open meeting. I'm thinking particularly of an agency meeting that I participated in where they were looking for specific input from the healthcare community, and we did small group discussions and reported back, and it was really a working session with the public as opposed to a debate or give and take or anything like that. And would that put any of those kind of working sessions with the public at risk of being able to continue? Would it make it more difficult for agencies to do that? Perhaps the DNR could comment on that. I'm just trying to think about how this really changes the way that agencies do meetings now.
Mr. Meyer?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I can't speak for all agencies that are out there, but it could certainly prohibit some of those innovative kind of comment collecting methods that are out there trying to get input. We haven't done anything like that, but we do meetings sometimes that we use clickers, all this technology that's out there, it is a concern that we have by limiting our ability to be innovative and continue with, you know, best government practices and trying to get input, that by restricting open houses doesn't constitute a meeting. I think there's better ways to accomplish the goal that Representative Green is looking at. So,
well, Mr. Meyer, to that point, as I read the bill, all it's saying is that if you have an open house, that doesn't count as the meeting that you're going to have that is required by law. Mm-hmm. So if you're required to have a public meeting by law, mm-hmm. it just can't be an open house format. Nothing's prohibiting you from having an open house formatted meeting. That just doesn't mm-hmm. constitute as the meeting that is required for you to have mm-hmm. as law would require you. Is that how you interpret that, or do you disagree with that statement? As I read Section 2.
Mr. Chair, I think some of it is just semantics that we're talking about. I mean, do you just call it a public meeting and you use an open house format and take public comment? Would that meet the requirements of the law? And I guess that's the way I would look at it. An open house does not constitute a meeting, but can a meeting be partly an open house? I mean, I would assume the law would allow that, right? It would just have to conform through Chapter 13 what a public meeting would be and meet those requirements. And again, there's many, many requirements to public meetings throughout not only DNR, but every state agency that's there. One other concern I have, Mr. Chair, just moving to Section 3 really quickly, is before acquiring real property and fee, what does before acquiring mean? Could we have a purchase agreement signed? If not, is this going to lead to speculation by developers? Say if Minsky was looking to buy some land for a new building site, and before they could do that, they had to have a public meeting, and somebody would go buy that land, and then I think there's some clarification that needs to be added to that section as well if this bill moves forward.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer. Representative Halverson, any follow-ups? Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm glad this is going on to civil law, because maybe there would be an amendment too that could specify. You know, you want spoken public comments, not written, and you want the opportunity for those comments to be accepted as testimony, which again the format you're describing does not allow. So I just think though that maybe the language could be tightened up so that, you know, you're specifying that. Thank you,
Representative Seltzer.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and it is good that it's moving on, but I do have a question. This is just born of my experience as a school board member and the definition of open meeting, so I apologize if that's not within our purview, but I'm just wondering if the law as written is going to do what you want it to do. Representative Green, I heard you say that was no opportunity for back and forth or for a discussion. And we were closing a school, and there were just numerous open meetings with the posting and the public commentary, but constituents were very frustrated because the law did not allow us to respond because we were a board, and so we had to speak with one voice. I'm just wondering, and again, this would be for legal counsel, but if this as written would do what you want it to do, which is to provide that back and forth.
Representative Green,
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that we're getting a little bit into the weeds now. If a county board, and maybe Ms. Dyson can clarify this, if a county board chooses to allow the dialogue, I think they can. I think the chair of a committee, I'm pretty sure that the chair of a board can open up the public to public comment. But if not, that's not what this is doing. This is allowing for the open exchange of ideas. That's all it's doing. It's not really complicated. I think that it also, as was pointed out, I have it written here, but thankfully the chair touched on it, is that it doesn't say you can't have an open house. It just says by law you need an open meeting and you need that exchange of ideas. And if that makes life harder for an agency, then so be it, because we're not here to represent the agency, we're here to represent the people.
Ms. Dyson, do you have any follow-up to that as far as the functionality of how the bill is drafted and what it's saying? So I guess Representative Seltzer's question is, will this allow kind of the open exchange of ideas in a meeting? Or would you rather not comment? or shall we move on and you can think about it?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Scott.
I can guarantee you that when it comes to my committee, we'll be taking a close look at it. And Matt Gehring, who's House Research on that, is he's a walking Chapter 13. So we will get this ironed out for sure.
Thank you. I withdraw my question. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question comes on line 1.15. Acquiring real property in fee and agency, and then it continues on. Question maybe for Ms. Dyson or Mr. Shepherd. Do we have a statutory definition of fee?
Mr. Shepherd.
Mr. Chair, members, I don't know of any definition that would apply to all statutes. I think it would be the commonly understood legal definition of a fee purchase where you're acquiring the entire rights, the entire property rights to
Representative
not an easement.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Okay. The reason I ask that is in Minnesota there are multiple number of different fee interests one can have in real property. One is a fee simple absolute. Maximum private control over land, which my assumption is what this is talking about, but there's also qualified fee or fee simple, which is so long as a condition is met for ownership, and then the third being a life estate, so long as one may live. And it seems to me that the DNR might acquire certain properties because of the nature of their agency, where people may own property and say, we're going to donate this 80 acres of property to the Department of Natural Resources or to the state of Minnesota, so long as it's preserved as environmental or it's this or it's that. I guess my question becomes, does the proposed legislation cover that type of transaction of land acquisition or not?
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative O'Driscoll, I don't think that's the intent of the bill. If someone wanted to donate their property, that the open meeting, that's why it says in property and fee, that's why that's in there. You know, we could probably have long personal discussions on the amount of land that's already out of the tax rolls. That's in public domain. I think that it's far too much. It's in excess of 25%. If you add in the easements, we're probably getting closer to a third of Minnesota that's impacted. But that it's not my intention to go after and tell somebody you can't donate your land. It is, although I think prudent for this body to decide at some time how much state money will be spent in acquiring land that comes off the tax rolls.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Chair Scott, this is probably more in the purview, perhaps, of your committee when you talk about civil law for a definition of that, because there are multiple definitions. And I, as Representative Green said, he does not want to hamper donations, but when it says acquire, it doesn't talk about for a fee, or it doesn't talk about the method of acquiring. It just says acquiring, so it's pretty broad. So when you have the walking Chapter 13 looking at different provisions, this might be one that you may want to ask for as well, just so that there isn't a question about that when we talk about the various fee interests.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this might be for Ms. Dyson as well. She might be phoning a friend here, and I'll pose the question first to the author of bill, Representative Green. But I think maybe a comment before is that the point is that an open house is not a formal recorded function of dialogue. Would that be your understanding of the definition of an open house?
Representative Green.
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, the definition that I have of an open house is from the experience of the open houses that I've gone to that the agency has put on. And so as far as what you're asking, you may also, like you say, have to ask Ms. Dyson that. But the open houses that I've attended just simply do not allow for people to congregate and ask questions openly. It would be, well, let's use this room again. If
there was a group of people that came in and wanted to ask you questions, if we wouldn't allow them to sit here and ask you questions, but they had to go down the row and ask each one individually to get their answer. Would that be serving the public? That's the gist of it.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Dyson, is there a definition in terms of the responsibilities for holding an open house, or is it just more a formality? I mean, I understand an open house, say in context of the real estate or open house for graduation, where there is really it's an informal setting where there is not a, as Representative Green has suggested, a fair and open giving and taking of ideas and or sharing of the answers that might be recorded. It's off the record, if you will. Mm-hmm. Would that be a correct characterization for an open house?
Ms. Dyson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, I think you're correct. An open house is sort of an undefined setting in which an agency can present information. That it can also receive comments and answer questions. As I stated before, an official meeting does not require the person accepting comments to respond to any questions. And that's, so this bill doesn't, in my view, this bill does not result in the agency answering any questions. This requires them to accept comments.
Mr. Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Green, with that response from Ms. Dyson, does that help or hinder public discourse with regard to land acquisition, in your opinion?
Representative Green.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, I don't think that that's going to be a problem, but if it is, I can amend the bill, but I would have to speculate that if you have a group of people in an open meeting and they are asking questions and they're not getting answers, there probably will be some discourse. So I think that they would get their answers there. And if that becomes a problem, then we'll go and fix that too.
Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, I think that the nexus of the issue is, again, definitional, but I think the point that Representative Green is making, particularly as it relates to acquisition of real estate on behalf of the state that we all live in, I think it is, and I share Representative Green's assertion that there is a necessity for, rather than an underwhelming, an overwhelming preponderance of evidence that the agency has provided opportunity for individual citizens to be heard and to be responded to with their concerns. And so I would support the language in the bill pursuant to any amendments.
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Green. I thank you for bringing this bill forward, because I think just the discussion here alone says that there's some confusion about what an open house is, and is it really allowing for dialogue. When I think of an open house, I think of it's a way to go see something. You know, we'll have open houses to see what a trail will do, a new plan will do, and sit next to the realtor, it'll be to see a house. You don't necessarily plan for a back and forth dialogue. And that is very concerning to me, that there would be a land exchange or acquisition. And yes, you can go to an open house and maybe look at it, but you don't necessarily, I mean, if you have to go to each table to talk to somebody, that isn't what we're looking for in a land acquisition. It should be somewhere where you get the feedback from the agency, not necessarily just one person. So I think we do have a lot of work to do, because I was kind of looking through the statute. There's no mention of what, I mean, I'm not seeing a definition for an open meeting. And when I look for the definition of open meeting, it's basically to go see. Nowhere do I see a dialogue, a back and forth, you know, communication. It's just seeing. And so I really thank you for bringing this forward, and I think there's work to do, and as Representative and Chair Scott said, you know, we'll have the opportunity to look at it further and figure out if maybe we need to figure out a definition for open house. But right now, I think you've got a good thing going, because I think there is a lot of confusion about what an open house is. And for all the years that I've gone to an open house, whether it be to a school, a home, to the city to look at their new plans or what, it's not necessarily that there's a dialogue. It's basically you might get to talk to somebody, but you might not be able to either, depending on how many people are there. And if you want to just talk to a certain somebody, there's no guarantee you can do that. At least with, you know, if you have a public meeting, if you sign up to testify, they will call your name and you can decline or not to speak, but at least you get a chance to speak out and everybody knows what you say. Open house, not everybody gets to hear what you say. And so I really hope that we can figure this out, because I think you're on the right track, and I really hope that we can get this passed through. I think it's a great bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Pice. Assistant Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, just briefly, and I need to explore this with Representative Green. I'm not sure if the meeting that he's referring to was actually even required to take place. Many times we have open houses just to inform people what's going on. So I need to see if this is a required meeting or not, because we are not required to have open meetings, in which case we would want to just have one-on-one conversations with people. But I will get more information on that and get that back to you. I just want to express, and I can only speak for the DNR, but this bill impacts the entire executive branch. As it moves forward, if there is language added dealing with answering public comments or things like that, we need to try to make sure there's a fiscal note requested on it. As I think back to the 60,000 plus comments we received from PolyMet and our need to answer those questions, that cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. Now, that was paid for by the project proposer, but answering these questions and going through, if we're requiring formal public comment responses and things like that, that can add up very quickly. So I'm just thinking of like Human Services or Department of Health, if they're have a meeting that this would be required to, now that the unintended consequences we need to make sure are dealt with. So thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think Mr. Myers touched on a little bit what I'm going to ask here, but we're talking about a county board, school board, the legislature. We have open meetings on our committee process here. We know who the governing board is, but if the DNR is acquiring land, or Minsky's acquiring land, and they're required to have a open meeting, who's the governing board? I mean, they require, is it going to be the head of the DNR, or are they going to require the governor? Because ultimately, he's the head of the state, that's head of the agencies that are doing the acquiring. Who is going to be required to hold this meeting? Because they're really, the DNR doesn't hold regular city council meetings or county board meetings when they acquire property, they have to go to the county board, which is required to have held to the open meeting laws. So who, Representative Green, do you envision being the governing board that's going to be holding these meetings?
Representative Green.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the bill simply states that the agency that is going to acquire the property has to have an open meeting. That's what it states. Mm-hmm. So if the agency that wants to purchase the property moves forward with it, then they are the agency that will hold the meeting. Mm-hmm. That's what it says.
Mm-hmm. If they're required by law to hold a meeting. That's what Section 2 says. So, follow-up, Representative Nelson.
Well, Mr. Chair, then if they're not required to hold a meeting,
then I don't see that this bill would affect them.
Yeah, but who's going to hold that meeting? I don't know. I don't see it doing a whole lot. I guess that's what I'm trying to get my mind around it.
Sure. I understand where everyone's coming from. I think in some instances, certainly it sounds like, Representative Green, we have a little work to do between now and civil law. It sounds like a lot of this are civil law questions and issues. And some interesting conversations have come up, whether or not open house has an actual statutory definition, those sorts of things. But I think Section 2 is pretty clear that if a state agency is required by law to hold a meeting, again, and I appreciate Assistant Commissioner Myers' comments that we're talking semantics in a sense, but an open house doesn't qualify as that statutory definition of a meeting. That's what this bill says. So whatever the intentions are beyond that, I mean, that's a different conversation. But as of right now, this bill says that if they're required by law to hold a meeting, that just can't be an open house. And they would have to follow current law under what that meeting what that meeting would be. I have two more member comments, and we have one additional person that would like to testify from the public. I have Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Chair Sanders, and thank you for you made it very clear, and that's exactly what I wanted to talk to, and thank you so much for clarifying. I appreciate Representative Green and what you're trying to do. I just don't know if this bill gets you there, because we heard from Ms. Dyson that a definition and open meeting does not require a back and forth. It just requires to accept comments. And I think you want that back and forth, from what I'm understanding. You don't want constituents just to be heard. You want answers to be given. So I'm glad that it's going to have a few more stops. I'm very glad that Chair Scott's committee is going to be hearing it, too. I think there's some concerns. I know it's come up in the past that depending on where you do the acquisition of property, you could be costing the taxpayers more because you could be driving up the price then. So that's a discussion that I think will probably end up in civil law, but thank you, Chair Sanders, for the latitude today. And
always. Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Chairman Sanders, and I'll just be really brief. Representative Green, I like your bill. I'm really grateful that you brought this forward and this conversation that we've had today with regard to open meeting and the lack of clarity about that, I think, is really important. So I echo a lot of the comments that have been made. I most especially echo Representative Tice's comments. And, you know, I'm thinking about the most recent open house that I attended. It was at the Fort Snelling at the site of the bonding request for the Minnesota Historical Society to renovate their visitor center. And it was a fantastic open house. And that's exactly what it was. It was questions and answers. And I think virtually I would go so far as to say that everybody there was there because they're excited about this particular project. But I'm visualizing in my mind's eye that had it been different, had the number of people that were at the open house that I attended been upset about this, concerned about this, there would have been no way at that open house for them to, you know, voice their concerns on the record. And so, again, I just think this is an area that, you know, we do want to get public comment. We want to be certain that it's recorded, and I'm not certain exactly. I want to go back and really give consideration to the language here, but I think there's a real opportunity for us to address this, and I'm glad you got this conversation started. So, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Pugh. Mr. Heller, thank you. You've slipped us a note asking us to testify. We'd love to have you come down and briefly testify. And if you would, just state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
My name is Rick Keller. Unofficially represent the Twice Exceptional Disabled. Thank you, Chair, Government Operations and Election Policy Committee members, to speak on House File 2603. In 2009, historically, this group had a bill go through that created a new state agency called MANET, also known as Office Enterprise Technology, and had to do with content accessibility law. That agency works on acquisition. One of the words that are on your meeting minutes here. Acquisition is an important piece for how people engage themselves with content. Based on multiple ways of expression, multiple ways of representation, which provides more engagement and motivation for the public, which is the goal for American Disability Act, which was reset in 2010. I have a story if anybody. I'm currently, I use data practice law. I testify at school board meetings when I get an opportunity. I testified two Mondays ago. It's online. You'll find this banner I have. The big letters were put up in front of that school board, and they asked me to take it down, so now I'm going to take it down because this committee currently doesn't have streaming video, but does have audio, and it does not have closed captioning in these meetings. I think it's relevant for everybody to be engaged, the whole audience, as related to the Higher Education Act when they added the word opportunity. In 2008, it added only two lifetime learners, blindness and print disability. Who are they? We know, I think, frankly, who have blindness. But who are the people that are print disabled? They're people that have a high ability and level to provide input for the public. I think it's important that the part I talked about, multiple ways of representation, expression, and motivation engagement, is a principle of universal design, also known as universal design for learning. Again, I think the word opportunity equates to that, as they added that in the Workforce Innovation Act in 2014. So as far as my story with the school board, they told me that when I held up my banner, because they don't have closed captioning at school boards and the FCC doesn't require them to do that, they told me if I didn't put it down, I could never testify again. Based on their policies, I was only addressing the school board. However, as you know, they stream those. So as you wrap your hands, and there's scribes in this meeting that can write more effectively than I perhaps can, but I think I can communicate orally quite well at a high level. Perhaps that's something that someone would entertain with the revisor's office or with myself or both. Once again, just so we all know, Minnesota Statute 1603 only requires state agencies. As we all know now, the University of Minnesota is not a state agency. Neither are school districts. They're exempt from context disability law, which is 508 of the 1973 Rehabilitation Act and 2.0 web content accessibility guidelines. So now we're going to move perhaps that law in the local, such as counties, cities. What would be the potential for people to provide important feedback when you have functional websites on based on how people represent or express themselves, or both, as it relates to the effect network, which is the why of learning, of universal design for learning, the what, how, and why. So again, we want to get more people engaged in content, and it's not the newspaper anymore. We're in 21st century, and since technology allows the 92% of us are born to acquire information orally, to effectively communicate that way orally. Input function oral, output oral function. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. If there's any questions, I'd be glad to provide that.
Thank you, Mr. Heller, for your testimony. Any other public testimony on this bill? Seeing none, any final member discussion to the bill? Seeing none, I'll renew my motion that House File 2603 be referred to the Committee on Civil Law as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
No.
The motion prevails. House File 2603 is referred to Civil Law.
Thank you.
With that, the final bill on our agenda today is Representative O'Driscoll and House File 887. I believe, Representative O'Driscoll, you can make a motion to send this to Commerce.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 887 be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Regulation.
Representative O'Driscoll moves that House File 887 and be referred to the Committee on Commerce. To your bill.
Mr. Chair, before I get started, this bill was introduced over a year ago, and since that time, some of the provisions that are in this bill have already been enacted into law, and with the indulgence of the committee, I know we like to have amendments beforehand, but I have spoken to Representative Nelson, to yourself, and indulge the committee if we could just strike Section 1, because that was put in the environment bill last year. And then just renumber accordingly. Otherwise, you'd have redundancy in statute as it relates to this, and it could cause some confusion as the revisor works on this, should it continue to make its pathway through the legislature.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Representative Nelson, would you mind commenting on whether or not you're okay with deleting Section 1 of this House file?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll make that motion. Representative O'Driscoll came to me before the meeting and explained that, just what he said here, that it's already been, that part's already been passed, so to get eliminate the redundancy, I'll move and make the motion to strike Section 1 and renumber accordingly.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Representative Nelson moves an oral amendment to delete Section 1 from the bill and renumber the sections accordingly. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Well, with that, Representative O'Driscoll, our committee technically loses jurisdiction over this bill. I'm happy to allow any testimony from any or any questions or comments from the committee if there is any. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Kahn in the past has talked about the lottery bill as being a tax on the stupid. And I guess with those that don't claim those prizes, I guess she would probably say those are the really stupid because they beat the odds and won. And so there's a double tax on them. But yeah, all joking aside, I know we're not the fiscal committee and this is going to civil law and I won't see it, so I want to make my comments here about that. We need to be careful here because this does, by taking the money that currently goes into the general fund and directing it someplace else, create a hole in our general fund budget. And so we want to make sure that when we do these things that we're looking at the overall budget and not realize that we're causing problems elsewhere. And right, at the current time, we do have a slight projected surplus, but that can evaporate, as we found from November to February, that can evaporate real quickly. So we want to be careful when we're moving money and spending money that we make note of it. And like I guess I know we're not the fiscal committee, so just make my comments now because I don't serve on the Commerce Committee.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Any other?
Mr. Sanders, if I could just share a few comments. There was a discussion earlier this week that Representative Nash had referred to my direction as to whether or not freshmen should be bringing treats, and I'm testifying today, so I've asked Representative Anderson to bring cookies to share with the committee. So if you'd like to start passing those around, that'd be great. On a serious note, Mr. Chair, this is an issue that is as old as the state of Minnesota. In order for the state of Minnesota to become a state, the Enabling Act required under federal law that one section in each of the townships across the state of Minnesota be a set aside for the benefit of school children in the state of Minnesota. If you think about the Ingalls girls in the Little House on the Prairie series, where they went to school, the one-room schoolhouse, Laura and her sisters and her friends, that is on that property is on school trust lands. That property would be used in a way to be able to receive profit through agricultural use, mining use, timber, whatever the case may be, to pay for school supplies and the school teacher. Since that time, we have chosen and found other ways to do education and fund education in the state of Minnesota, but these lands are still held in trust for the kids in the state of Minnesota. One of the endeavors that I took along with then Representative Dietrich, who was in the Minnesota House at the time, was to undertake establishing the School Trust Lands Commission, which is a separate set of legislators in the House and the Senate that would overlook the legislature's interests in these properties. The bill I brought before you today is a bipartisan bill. It's a bill that has been agreed upon by the Commission as a way to seek funding. Why lottery proceeds, forfeited lottery proceeds? When we agreed to do the lottery in the state of Minnesota under the constitutional amendment, there was a provision that dealt with environment and preserving environmentally sensitive areas. And it's our environmentally sensitive areas that the DNR has prioritized at the direction of the state legislature for purchase from the kids to keep those in the hands of the public. Some will offer to us and say, because they're in trust lands and managed by the state of Minnesota, they're owned by the state of Minnesota. That is not true. There's a separate trust holding of those lands and fiduciary duties that are required. And so this bill endeavors to help the DNR to be able to find money to be able to make the purchase that they're required to do under the prioritization of about $85 million worth of lands. There could be anywhere from $1 to $10 million a year losses, depending upon, using Representative Nelson's paraphrase of Representative Kahn, the really stupid who didn't come and claim their winnings on this. But nonetheless, this has always enjoyed bipartisan support, and we continue to want to have this conversation. And today, as I was preparing my testimony, in 4 short years, because this is when we did it, was the second year of the first biennium that I was here. In 4 years, there are 9 of the 16 members on this commission, on this committee, who were not here 4 short years ago when we enacted this into law. To just give you an opportunity to see how fast the legislature shifts and moves, we still owe this fiduciary duty to the kids in the state of Minnesota. So, Mr. Chair, with that, I know that you, with the amendment, we have lost jurisdiction, and it will probably end up going back and being re-referred again to the appropriate committee, which probably will be, you can go to Commerce from here, but you're right, there may be a technical issue. But nonetheless, thank you for the opportunity to remind people and to continue to talk about the need for managing our school trust lands according to our fiduciary duties. Mr. Chair, thank you.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. I do know for sure this has to go to Commerce, and we'll go to State Government Finance. I know those two for sure. We'll see if anything else pops up along the way. With that, I don't have any other member questions or discussion on the list. Anyone of the public that wishes to testify to the sections in this bill as amended? Mr. Heller, if you have comments to the bill as amended, we could take those briefly. You have to state your name again for the record.
Rick Heller, unofficially represent the Twice Exceptional Apprentice Able. Thank you, Chair of Government Operations Policy Committee, and members for speaking on House File 887. It's my understanding regarding lotto money, 10% goal to dedicated. People that have habits, or should I say, something they can't break, they call it addiction. It's my understanding that this bill is, correct me if I'm wrong or not, but to take unclaimed money from people that are impoverished, that try to get the American dream, with really quite a false hope regarding their odds to win. And frankly, if that isn't too sharp, I don't know what isn't. But now we're going to take this money and get land for the students. Isn't this really tainted money? Isn't it bloodied money that we're allowing to take money from people that, frankly, always wanted to acquire an American dream, but frankly couldn't read well by third grade, never found themselves in the opportunity pipeline, or should I say the talented pipeline now, or should I say school or prison, depending how you want to look at it. And so again, so we're going to allow school districts to tap into bloodied money based on what they've done to students in the past regarding the opportunity gap. I don't know, I have a, there's something about this whole piece that, why don't we reach back down to the individuals that are trying to get the opportunity, the economically disadvantaged, the ethnic groups, the twice exceptional, frankly. It's an important piece of this, and frankly, to just put it in land money, I don't see anybody having any bills for those people. And to have a lingual word in a statute, yet school districts aren't required to even track who the twice exceptional or apprentice able are, is frankly discouraging, especially when the Higher Education Opportunity Act of 2008 only identified 2 lifetime learners. So I'm kind of at a loss about how school districts keep piling up their money and frankly now dipping in the blood money based on those individuals that end up in prison or frankly never really met their full potential.
Thank you, Mr. Heller, for your comments. Seeing no further testimony with that, no further member discussion. With that, Representative O'Driscoll will renew his motion that House File 887 be referred to the Committee on Commerce as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails, and House File 887 is on its way to Commerce.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Members, I know that, I believe it's tomorrow. The Government Operations Elections Committee Subcommittee on Metropolitan Council Accountability and Transparency will be hearing two bills. It should be in your packets. Just want to make members aware of that. Other than that, that should take care of our business for the week, and we'll look forward to a busy week next week. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to ask about that. What do we look like for next week? And do we have the agendas laid out yet? Or
thank you, Representative Nelson. We will be releasing at least Tuesday and Wednesday's agendas today, if not the full week. I do believe that we have most of the week planned out. We have bills every day next week. Looks like 3 to 4 bills committee hearing as of right now. But we'll get that out to you as soon as we can today. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess the other question with that, you talked about when we heard the presidential primary bill. Is that going to be on the agenda next week, or are we still waiting to get language squared away with the Senate on that?
Thank you, Representative Nelson. It is our intention to hear it next week. I believe the Senate jackets are being dropped today, at which point we will have the House jackets. So at that point in time, we will, as soon as that happens, we'll make sure that you have the language, and we'll work with when that hearing will be.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You bet. Representative Seltzer.
Mr. Chair, you said that the bills for tomorrow's meeting should be in our packet. I don't have it. No?
I guess I'm not sure, Representative Seltzer. I have a list. It's House File 2104.
No, I don't have it.
So it was that one. It's there.
Oh, just this?
Yeah. Yes.
Great.
Sorry. Thanks. Yes. Perfect. Any other questions? With that, thank you, members. We are adjourned.